My name is Stanley Laham, L-A-H-A-M. My background is in immunology and infectious diseases. I obtained my doctorate back in 1978, and I've been your guest before. Hopefully your listeners will know.
Now, Stanley, we've had a blockbuster announcement on the BBC, TV, radio, and in the newspapers in the UK about a revolutionary new type of vaccine. Obviously, vaccines are very much in the news, and the vaccine companies in the news too, about the amazing success that apparently that they've had with the rollout of these vaccines in Britain and other countries. But this is something completely new to me, because I didn't realise that it was possible to get a vaccine against malaria. I was under the impression that vaccines were something that you got against, say, a virus, like like the common cold virus we've got with, or the SARS virus with SARS-CoV-2. So can you just explain that, maybe a little bit first of all about what malaria actually is and how it operates? It's a parasite with a complicated life cycle.
Correct. And malaria is a disease. It's hard to really say who's the reservoir, humans or mosquitoes, but it's been agreed that mosquitoes are the primary reservoir, more specifically the Anopheles mosquito. And in the mosquito, the malaria undergoes what they call sexual reproduction. Then it is introduced in people through the bite of the female Anopheles. And the pathogenesis is, it goes through many, many different cycles. An infected Anopheles mosquitoes will inject the plasmodial parasite in the form of what they call sporozoites. It is then picked up by hepatic parenchymal cells. And in the liver, it undergoes many life cycles, all of them asexual.
Okay, so what type of cells pick it up? What are those cells?
Hepatic cells of the parenchyma of the liver. And they culminate, after going through many cycles, they culminate into the release of a form called merozoites into the bloodstreams. And when they escape, the ruptured hepatic cells, they penetrate into red blood cells, transform into trophozoites. These trophozoites mature into something called schizonts. And each of them produce now another form of merozoites, depending on the species of Plasmodium, of malaria, because malaria is caused by the parasite Plasmodium. And these developed merozoites, ruptured red blood cells, initiate what they call schizogony in uninfected red blood cells, reappear as gametocytes in the blood, and are again ingested by female mosquitoes. And in the female mosquitoes, these gametocytes differentiate into male and female, like a sperm and an egg, in the gut of the mosquito, where they reproduce, and they become oocysts and sporozoites, which migrate to the saliva of the mosquito and is re-injected into men.
Oh, okay, so this is a bizarre idea here, is that as this particular Anopheles mosquito is biting into the human, so it may be actually ingesting the parasite into itself at the same time as it's actually injecting that same parasite into a human.
Correct. It gets the parasite from the human in a form, not in the form in which it re-injects it into the next human. In other words, the mosquito that bites somebody with malaria and still has the malaria parasite in the form that it is in the blood of the human, and let's say immediately goes to someone else and bites someone else, will not transmit the malaria. It has to be digested, go into the intestine of the mosquito, where it reproduces into another form, remigrates to the saliva, and then the mosquito becomes infectious for the next person.
Now hang on a minute, because I mean, I had no ideas that mosquitoes even had saliva. I thought that when a mosquito bit you, that really all it was doing was sucking blood out of you in order to feed on you.
Actually, the first thing it does is it drops malaria on your skin, which contains also an anesthetic, so that while it's biting you, you don't feel it. You usually only feel it after, unless you actually see it biting you.
Ah, so before it's actually
the saliva,
amazing,
the
mosquito, yeah.
Yeah, contains a minute amount of local anesthetic. That's something that's been known for a long time. And by the way, malaria was first described by Hippocrates. And since then, he classified it into three different types of malaria. The one in which you have daily fever, which is the falciparum type of malaria. On getting fever on alternate days is the Plasmodium vivax. And the one in which you get infection every 3 to 4 days is actually what we call the Plasmodium malariae. And the word malaria itself comes from bad air, because people thought, its association with the bad air and stagnant, swampy area, which begun what we call the miasmal theory of infectious diseases, as opposed to the microbial theory of infectious diseases, which Pasteur and Koch actually proved, a thousand years later.
Now, okay, so this whole idea is a bit complicated, isn't it? Because, I mean, I can remember a chap that I worked with years ago. I mean, he caught malaria when he was out in some tropical country somewhere. And then when he came back to work in Britain, it would be maybe once a year he would have a terrible spell of malaria and be very sick. So this is a disease which it seems like your body somehow manages to keep it at bay, but every now and again it resurfaces.
Yes, and the place where it remains dormant and resurfaces is usually in the liver. The form of the parasite that stays in the liver, not in the blood, and can reappear, later on. But if it's well treated, usually if it's very well treated, because there are, treatments, the primary treatment is hydroxychloroquine, which destroys the parasite in the form that it is in the blood, which is what we call the schizonts. And primaquine, which is used to destroy the gametocytes that are in the liver. And that's how, malaria is controlled two ways. First of all, by treatment. And there are sometimes when chloroquine doesn't work that well, quinine can be used, trimethoprim, pyrimethamine, the names are sometimes sulfonamides, but it is treatable, and you can kill. There are, you know, different chemicals from chloroquine to primaquine that attacks the malaria either when it's in the form of the parasite in the blood, in the bloodstream, or in the form of the parasite in the liver. The other thing is the control of mosquitoes. And, you know, controlling mosquitoes with insecticide or chlorinating water indirectly controls malaria because it kills the larvae of the mosquito in stagnant waters. Very little concentration of chlorine kills the larvae of mosquitoes. So chlorine is also an important tool in indirectly controlling malaria by controlling mosquito population. And unlike chlorine being directly an agent to control Shigella, which causes cholera by killing the Shigella bacteria in water, very low concentration of chlorine. And as you know, that curse of cholera, which did its ravages in London, would have been easily controllable with chlorine if water had been chlorinated.
Okay, so with this announcement, what do you make of this idea that you know, with this enormous new program, that maybe malaria might be eliminated?
I don't believe. First of all, I have to plead ignorance because I haven't seen the scientific papers where they say what exactly is in the vaccine and how it elicits immunity and to what form, because in humans it goes through about four different forms with, you know, of, you know, it's an evolving organism. It goes through about four different forms. So I don't know against which form the vaccine would be effective. The second thing is that after repeated bouts of malaria, people develop immunity in the form of cellular immunity, killer T cells that can actually kill the plasmodium, the protozoa, and not humoral immunity, antibody immunity. So if they talk about this vaccine, and like I said, I have not seen the scientific papers concerning that vaccine. I was not aware of it. But if it's to elicit antibody response, like, for example, the COVID vaccine, it would be almost an absurdity. But from the article I read, from the non-scientific article I read from the BBC, the article itself, it defeats the purpose of, you know, of the vaccine, because it seems to be effective only at 30%, not in preventing malaria, but at 30% in preventing more severe symptoms of malaria. So it doesn't sound... Like I said, I'm speaking from a point of ignorance because I don't know how the vaccine is elaborated and I don't know what kind of immune response that it supposedly elicits. But from what I know about malaria, I doubt very much that there can be an effective antigenic vaccine.
Why is that?
Because there are too many different antigens, too many different forms that the same thing. For example, what is the vaccine effective against which form? The schizonts, the gametocytes? Exactly what does the vaccine do? I don't know. So like I said, I, you know, not being in the loop, I don't know what this vaccine does. And I was only aware of it from, the vulgarization that we get in the press, like what I read in the BBC.
What's the track record on these finding vaccines for malaria?
Zero, as far as I know.
But there are, the treatments in the past, there's been all sorts of experiments, surely, trying to eliminate malaria.
Yes, and for example, in Haiti in 1959, Dr. François Duvalier, who had become president in Haiti, better known to the world as Papa Doc, had a program called SNEM, Service National de l'Eradication de la Malaria, National Service for the Eradication of Malaria. And by using chloroquine and primaquine, by chlorinating water, by destroying, using insecticides, malaria was eliminated by 90% in Haiti, in a place where it was really, Haiti had become a malaria cesspool. And this program effectively eliminated malaria by 90%.
Well, that's sounds almost, if this vaccine can achieve that, Stanley, that's doing pretty well, isn't it?
Right, that's precisely, yeah. Whereas what the vaccine seems to be promising, again, I will say I did not read the scientific papers, is to reduce by 30% the rate of severe malaria. And would reach the, it reminds me of the remdesivir fiasco. Supposedly, it will be more accessible than sleeping nets for children. It will reach children where sleeping nets will not reach them to protect them against mosquito. And I would imagine where insecticide and chlorine would not be available to treat stagnant waters. And, it just doesn't sound right. If you read the article released by the BBC and the statistic released by the WHO, it doesn't make sense to use such a vaccine. It seems to me, let me be plain, to be a money-making scheme for one of the big pharmas.
Well, can you just elaborate on why you think that, obviously if you're trying to persuade people to sleep under nets to use chlorine, for example, that's not always so effective. At least with a vaccine, you can get somebody in front of you, inject it into them, and you know they've had it. But it's very difficult to convince people that they need to sleep under a net every night, for example.
Well, I think perhaps people in England or in the US don't know that, but people in the third world know that as they say, a moustiquaire is one of the best way. It was standard. It used to be standard equipment, in a bedroom or over a bed. Now, if you can make a vaccine that has to be kept at a certain temperature, that has to be transported to the farthest corners of Africa or Asia, I suppose you could give, sleeping nets. Nobody would refuse it. And I think it's much easier to convince somebody to sleep, with a moustiquaire over them than to convince them that you're going to inject something into their bloodstream, unless it's done forcibly.
What's the track record like of these various trials of vaccines by the big pharmaceutical companies in Africa?
Well, we've had some examples of very bad track records where they tried a vaccine for dengue fever that was very nefarious. And dengue fever would be a much easier thing to, it's a virus without a complicated life cycle. it would be a lot easier to elaborate a vaccine against dengue fever than against malaria, which, notice, are both scourges of the third world, of the lands of the South, let me put it this way. Yet they have not come out with a good dengue virus or yellow fever virus. Yellow fever that decimated many armies, you know, around the world. I don't see how they can come up with a vaccine to immunize against, you know, malaria, especially when this immunization should involve especially stimulating T killer lymphocytes. Because in the end, it is T lymphocytes in people who have acquired natural immunity to malaria after infection, and usually after repeated infection, their immunity is derived from T lymphocytes, not humoral immunity, not circulating antibodies from B lymphocytes.
Can you just explain the difference between those two?
Well, we're going to have to do a course in immunology. Well, 101, okay. One, when you're studying immunology, you study, the first thing you study is that there are two types of immunity. Humoral immunity, humoral because it's in the humor and the blood, antibodies, circulating antibodies in the blood, and cellular immunity, with it, which is T lymphocytes. Now, since then, we have learned so much about the mechanism of action of humoral immunity and cellular immunity, but the main difference being that one is antibody mediated, the other one is T cell mediated. T lymphocytes become killer lymphocytes. That's your main immunity against such parasites or cancer cells or viral infected cells, whereas circulating viruses are attacked by circulating antibodies. A T cell, let's take a viral infection. You have a cell that's infected with a virus that's presenting viral antigen at its surface. A person that has developed immunity, T cells will actually attack their own infected cell and destroy it before it can produce enough virus to release them. Those that are escape the T cell immunity and viruses released into the bloodstream, then you have antibodies that will attach and fix complement and destroy the virus, you know, the circulating virus. I hope that's a good 5-minute lesson in cellular versus humoral immunity.
Well, it certainly is. But look, the World Health Organization is backing this 100%. In fact, it's talking about it as a breakthrough for science, the boss of the World Health Organization.
Well, like I said, Tony, I have to plead ignorance because I haven't read the scientific papers. I don't know how this vaccine is going to work, but it's difficult for me to conceive of how it's going to work, how it's going to stimulate T cell immunity, and against which form of the parasite, which takes about four different forms in the human body, meaning presenting four different types, you know, of antigenic structures. I don't know. And according to what I read in the popular press, not in scientific papers, because I haven't read the scientific papers concerning that, or how the you know, the vaccine was elaborated. Notice they will never tell you everything because some of it will be considered intellectual property not to be divulged. So until that is explained, I can't really pass judgment. But from what they claim that it will do, it's very little. its 30% effectiveness in reducing, you know, the severity of the malaria. So their own claim seems to disavow their vaccine. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Yes, and also apparently it's going to take several injections of this to have any real make any real difference at all. So, you know, this is another type of so-called vaccine, which certainly when I was a young man, a vaccine, you would have a vaccine and possibly one, you know, sort of in 20, 30 years later. But the idea was it gave you immunity. At least it gave you the ability to maybe not be hospitalized with a disease in order to give your own body's natural immunity a chance to fight it, because, you know, it would make it slightly more difficult for whatever the disease is to really get a hold on you. But anyway, look,
the correct scientific expression of this is that it gives your body the ability to have a secondary response to that antigen or to that pathogen instead of a primary response. That's what a vaccine allows you to do. A good vaccine, such as smallpox or the Sabin or Salk polio vaccines. That's what a good vaccine is supposed to, you know, to do. But now it seems that it is such a multi-billion-dollar business that it seems that people are searching for enemies to, you know, to destroy. They're searching for vaccines for any conceivable, you know, virus or infection, even if they're, you know, not very pathogenic.
Yeah, we've just had something start in Britain called the Health Protection Agency. It's a new part of the Department for Health and National Health Service, which seems to be all about protecting people. But what they're really saying is that we're just going to increase the vaccine program for newborn children and adults. And it seems to be on the back of this whole COVID-19 and the idea that there is no one vaccine. You've got to have at least two vaccines. And now, as we're seeing in Britain, these booster shots run. So that's three vaccines against COVID-19.
Yes. And then as new, and we've discussed that before, as new variants will appear, they will make new vaccines for the new variant's antigen. And we may find ourselves in the situation that we are with the flu, where you have a different flu vaccine, you know, every year, because the coronavirus has the same propensity to mutate and present new antigen as does the influenza virus.
Yes, yeah, so they're going to be four injections minimum, apparently, of this new one, Stanley. Is that normal?
No. You know, it's like they're, you know, it seems like in the Middle Ages, knights in search of dragons to slay for honor and for, but now it seems Big Pharma is in search of viruses to make vaccines to, and using the media to make one think it's necessary, and to have the greatest wealth accumulation one can think of. As a matter of fact, I heard that Pfizer, after having made over $1 billion profit, has increased the price of the vaccine, and people who get it for free don't seem to realize that they're paying for it with their tax money when it's the government paying for it. It's a transfer of wealth, you know, to the oligarchy. It's another way for to create great wealth inequality.
Now,
But that's another story.
well, yeah, but I mean, and also rolling the vaccines out to children, there's been quite a lot of controversy here in the UK about it, with quite a few figures, scientific and non-scientific, speaking out, being saying, well, really, this is unethical because the children are not actually vulnerable, and actually, this is an experimental vaccine. So anyway, what do you make? I mean, obviously, it's not just one vaccine. There's the main ones are the AstraZeneca, Pfizer, and Moderna here in the UK. What do you make of this whole idea of giving the vaccine to children? I mean, for example, we've had, in the past, most children in Britain have actually, and probably in the US too, have had the polio vaccine in the form of a little sugar cube. So why is it so controversial to be rolling out these COVID vaccines to children?
Well, I was also vaccinated, with the Sabin vaccine, which is the live polio vaccine. But now I would not feel good with the way Big Pharma, and we're talking about vaccines were developed by people who refused to patent them, who said that the patent, belongs to humanity. So there was no $1 billion to be made. Now, giving this mRNA vaccine to children, I find particularly alarming. One of the first concerns I had from the beginning when I first heard about mRNA vaccines back in March of 2020, I wrote about the dangers, the possible side effects of an mRNA vaccine. And one of them was that we also the mRNA is supposed to be taken up by our cells and translated into the viral protein, which migrates to the cellular membrane. But we also have another enzyme in our system called reverse transcriptase, which can reverse transcribe this mRNA into DNA. And that DNA may be inserted into plasmids, eventually into our genetic makeup, into the genetic, into the chromosome of some of the cells that do get absorbed that mRNA. Now, in children, that's particularly alarming because children are developing new cells. And for example, the master immunologic organ is the thymus. Now, the thymus, by the time you're 20, is atrophied. But during childhood, during adolescence, and even during embryogenesis, it's the master immunological organ that determines self versus non-self, that makes you make. Attack things that are not part of your embryogenesis as you were developing from a baby, from a fertilized egg to a baby and throughout adolescence. And with this mRNA vaccine, I can just imagine if some thymic cells, which are not active in adults, but very active in children, 2, 3, 4 year olds, would take that mRNA and reverse transcript it into DNA. I don't know for sure what the effects would be, but it cannot be good. And I don't know why they're pushing for it. Because if the adult population is vaccinated, then we have nothing to worry about. There will be. It's something they seem not to talk about when they're saying, well, let's go further down the age groups. If adults become fully vaccinated, then there should be herd immunity. If their vaccine is good, if the mRNA vaccines are good, then there would be herd immunity and children would be normally protected. So that's my concern as far as an mRNA vaccine which is still in the experimental stage. It will take years and years before we can say for certain that it's not taken up by hepatic parenchymal cells, lung cells. We already know that people have had reaction like pericarditis and myocarditis from it. And there's only one explanation for that, is that the myocardium was presenting viral antigen, which caused an inflammatory response. So that mRNA, which I postulated since it spoke about it, would not remain locally at the site of injection, obviously makes its way to other organs. And that would
can you just explain what myocarditis and pericarditis is, if I've got those terms correct? Because I think, you know, these are sort of, you know, obviously medical people and scientific papers will discuss these terms, but most listeners probably won't know what they mean.
Inflammation of the heart muscles and inflammation of the pericardium that envelopes the heart. Here's something that we all know about, I suppose, that the rheumatic heart fever. Rheumatic heart fever is when the heart muscles present streptococcus antigen. Therefore, it's very important that people who suffer from rheumatic heart fever not get streptococcal infection or a streptococcal vaccine, which would cause, you know, a severe bout of rheumatic heart fever, and if not treated in time, cause death. It's a question of now hospitals are on the lookout for it. There has been many. Your listeners can look it up. There have been enough cases for hospitals to be on the lookout for myocarditis and pericarditis caused by the vaccine, the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. And like I said, the only way that this can happen is if these organs are producing viral antigen and causing an inflammatory response, which means that the mRNA, there is no guarantee that the mRNA that's injected in the deltoid muscle in your arm will remain there. Some will inevitably get into your and be absorbed by other cells. Now, whether the effect will be nefarious was a question that was up in the air. But the fact that we're getting, you know, these cases of myocarditis as a direct result of vaccination sort of proves the point. As far as the liver is concerned, as far as liver reactions, we may see them, but these will take longer time. You see, the liver is not... You get heart inflammation, you know it right away. You get liver inflammation, you may not know it until 1 or 2 years or 3 years later.
Now, I suppose the obvious question is, we're now 10 months into this big experiment. Apparently, the experiment of these emergency use authorization vaccines is going to be finished in 2023, which is in another 2 years' time. But we're 10 months into this now. What are your thoughts about how well that experiment is going?
You know, we're living in a society where information is totally controlled, as opposed to the way what I was used to in the end of the 20th century, in the 1970s and 80s. It's difficult to say how that experiment is going because we're getting, doctored results. from time to time, we hear about the big snafus of that experiment. But then it's immediately covered up by, an onslaught of main media, mainstream media, great benefits of the vaccine. If you're in the United States and you're watching the late night shows, you know, something like ivermectin, which, you know, has proven beneficial in the treatment of COVID-19, has proven very beneficial in the treatment of COVID-19, unlike the remdesivir fiasco. You hear them talking about it here, and they call, oh, some crazy people are taking a horse dewormer. And yet, the elaborators, the people who elaborated ivermectin as a medication, got the Nobel Prize for it, and ivermectin was put in the list of medications, essential for humanity, just like hydroxychloroquine, which has saved millions and millions and millions of lives from malaria. So, to me, we won't know the true nature of this experiment, of the results of this experiment, until we get somebody like WikiLeaks or something like this gets into all the internal memos of the big pharmaceutical companies that have accumulated data on it. Because they have proven that they are not very honest when they're talking about the results.
Okay, so is there anything that you've seen over the last few months that's made you think, well, crikey, this deserves more media attention because it's not a good sign about how the experimental vaccines are going?
Yeah, well, this is something that deserves media attention, from more media attention. Not only more media attention, that's the wrong word, more media scrutiny. Because they have given it attention. They have propagandized it for Big Pharma. Because if you look at it in the United States, the same, you know, the same entertainment companies that have shares in the big pharmaceutical companies own the CNNs and the when you have Universal Studios and Disney owning CNN and MSNBC and etc., and they also have big shares in the pharmaceutical companies, the whole system becomes warped. So it's hard when you're asking me to judge the results of this experiment. Time will tell.
Okay. So what about, I mean, we've been talking about these mRNA vaccines, but there are two which are called mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, which are these very new type, I understand it's been something like 15 years attempts to get these vaccines approved. And it's only with the appearance of SARS-CoV-2 that's been possible. But there's also this AstraZeneca vaccine, which I understand is adenovirus or something. Is that correct? So can you just explain the difference between these mRNA ones and the AstraZeneca?
Well, the AstraZeneca is a copy. The first people who said, we're not going to put that mRNA directly into people. Instead, we're going to reverse transcript it into an adenovirus, which is a DNA virus, and immunize with that adenovirus so that adenovirus will present not only adenovirus antigens, which, by the way, causes common colds and stuff, but also present that coronavirus antigen. And the first vaccine to come out with that model was the Sputnik V. AstraZeneca has done the same, but for some reason, we know of about 30 different strains of human adenoviruses, serotypes of human adenoviruses. The Sputnik vaccine uses, serotype 5 and 26 of human adenovirus. For some reason, AstraZeneca chose to use a simian adenovirus, a monkey adenovirus, to put that supposedly bat mRNA into it to produce the antigen. So with the AstraZeneca virus vaccine, you're presenting two, remember that are this COVID-19 virus supposedly came from bats. So you're talking about a bat genetic adenovirus that they put into a simian, a monkey, a bat coronavirus that they put into a monkey adenovirus and use it as a vaccine. And I have no idea why AstraZeneca chose to do it with a simian adenovirus instead of a human adenovirus. And that's right, the difference.
So, yeah, so they're both different type of virus. Have you had any vaccines yourself? If so, which one?
Yes, the Johnson & Johnson, which is an adenovirus copied from the Sputnik, sort of the same protocol as the Sputnik V virus, using a different strain of human adenovirus. And the reason for that is because because of some of the social pressures.
Yeah, because there seems to be quite a lot of pressure on people to take this vaccine. Or at least one sort or another.
Let me give you an example. I have relatives who live in Haiti who now must take the vaccine before they can travel to the U.S. It's not a question pressure now, it's a must.
Well, that's, it's all these sorts of freedoms are being restricted. We've just had, for example, the Welsh Parliament in Cardiff have just said that they're going to have this vaccine passport for anyone to go to any kind of big event. They're going to have this thing. It does strike me that there are quite a few people out there who, for example, have had bad reactions to vaccines in the past, and particularly the young people who are not likely to really get seriously ill or die from COVID. They would be medically advised not to have such a vaccine and not to have a vaccine passport. So there seems to be a kind of twist in the direction of coercing people into having these, which isn't really... surely from a medical point of view, people should be making a clear medical choice, not one based around, whether or not they're going to be, their freedom's going to be limited or not.
Well, I don't know how it is, in the UK, but here in the United States, it's not just a twist. It's becoming, almost a mandatory, or you will be considered a pariah. Let me give you an example of this problem. Do you remember in one of our last interviews, I told you about my friends, husband and wife? The wife had COVID-19. I advised her against going to the doctor, who would not give her the time of day, sent her to the hospital. This was in the middle of 2020. When if you're in hospital, you couldn't see anybody, you could not receive any visit, and all you were told that were following CDC guidelines, period. So anyway, she got treated. I told you the whole thing about with ivermectin, azithromycin. I monitored her blood oxygen level, which remained great and everything. And she, you know, she recuperated nicely. And her husband, who had a heart attack before, caught it also, did the same treatment and recuperated. And they both had a very high level of antibodies. A few months ago, they came back to the U.S. And their doctor, his cardiologist, advised him to take the vaccine. I advised them against it. I said, you have much better immunity from having been naturally infected than... She didn't take it. Her husband took it, and he ended up 2 days later with a myocarditis in the hospital, Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami Beach, because that's where his cardiologist worked. Now, having had a heart attack, his insurance, which is a Dutch insurance, would, he had medical insurance, but heart problems were not covered. And I had to tell them to, look, this is not a heart attack. Do not talk of doing, you know, catheterization. To go. This is an inflammatory response that should be treated with due to the vaccination. And it was presented that way. I wrote a letter for them. And the insurance company accepted that explanation and paid for his hospital pay, or he would have been $100,000 in debt. That's how it is here. You guys don't know about that in the UK, but you can go broke in the United States from an episode that puts you 5 days in intensive care unit. And you see, you receive a bill of $100,000 more, you know, that you have to pay. So even his insurance company accepted that this was due not to a heart event. And it would have been to their advantage to say, well, this is a heart event, a cardiac event, not a vaccination-related event. But they accepted it and they paid. Now, here we are a few months later, and they need to travel. I said, well, you guys should get an exemption from the vaccine because you have high antibody titers, plus the cardiologists want him to take the booster. I said, if you take the booster, you know, you're going to have another heart event, another myocarditis. So now he's in the process of writing to see if he can travel, if he can get a medical exception from taking the vaccine, so that he can take American Airlines or JetBlue or anything and travel back and forth. Because starting in November, you're going to have to give proof of vaccination or have some kind of medical exemption. That's what we're, you know, that's the
state of affairs. Well, this is unprecedented. This is unprecedented, Stanley. Everybody in the world is being treated as if they're a carrier.
I know. That's the state of affairs.
And also, of course, you know, I myself, I had, I believe, COVID in December 2019, and I would suggest that I stand a pretty good chance of surviving it and maybe not spreading it around. But the idea that we need all these things to travel now just seems pretty extraordinary. Okay, so what about, you know, that the what would you say to anybody that's thinking, well, you know, actually, I don't really want this, but I do want to keep my freedom. Is it possible to have both, to not have a vaccine and still to keep your freedom to travel?
There's no way I can answer this question. This will be determined really by the government policy. As far here in the United States, it will be determined by the CDC, the airlines, and Pfizer and Moderna. They're the ones with Pfizer has 22 different lobbying firms working for them in Congress. This was in the news. So I wouldn't be surprised if they make it And the more people get vaccinated, the more money they make. I mean, it's as simple as that.
So the it doesn't sound as if it's all that ethical. But look, they keep talking about more, lots of different vaccines. You've got to have multiple shots of the same vaccine. It almost seems like an obsession, a money-making obsession with this. What about this idea at some point in the future, they'll say, oh, well, we've found a vaccine to cancer?
Well, that would be great news, except that for that one, they won't be able to get away from it unless it would be really efficacious. Let's say they say we found a vaccine to small cell lung cancer, what we used to call Hodgkin cell lung cancer. Well, if somebody who, you know, if people were vaccinated for it and then caught it, got small cell, lung cancer, you know, it would be catastrophic. I would imagine for them, though one never knows how they might spin the scientific evidence.
Well, that's precisely it, isn't it? Look, for COVID, this is precisely it. The scientific evidence isn't really there yet that any of these COVID-19 vaccines have not, none of them have actually yet been proven effective against a control group. The idea being that, potentially some of these vaccines, particularly with younger people, they may have suffered worse effects from the vaccine than they would have from catching COVID.
Well, up to now, the ill effects that are reported are those that I've told you about. As far as vaccinating children with the mRNA vaccine, I think one should wait a few years before ever thinking of doing that to see the effect of the mRNA virus. If there are secondary effects from liver, heart, lung, kidney in the years to come before you think of vaccinating children. To bring this to children right now, I think is not only unscientific but unethical and unconscionable.
Well, look, I know you're not an epidemiologist, you're an immunologist, right? But from an immunologist point of view, are there any countries around the world that you can point to as a good example of how they've dealt with this?
Yeah, many countries who have used antivirals instead of the vaccine. Well, it's very simple. The country that developed the vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, is the United States, and the United States has the greatest number of deaths per 100,000 than any other country in the world. So let's just leave it at that. And by the way, when you study immunology, you have to study epidemiology as well. So, and one of my first jobs was to see the endemicity, that is, the endemic occurrence of rabies in the animal population. I was testing sera for antibodies to the rhabdovirus, which is the rabies virus, in the feral population of certain animals here in Florida. This was one of my first postdoctoral works.
You haven't really answered my question there. I was asking, is there a good example of a country that's dealt quite well with all this?
Well, I think countries like in Central America that were using a protocol of ivermectin, azithromycin, steroids if necessary, have a much, much better track record than the United States, whether it's Honduras, El Salvador, even Haiti. So, these countries had a better track record. When I tell you that the United States has the greatest, you know, the greatest number of deaths per 100,000 than the most underdeveloped countries in Central America, yes, that is evidence that these countries have done better.
Okay, Stanley Laham, thanks very much for joining us.
Very good, Tony.